Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, and my guest today is Paul Zummo, Chief Investment Officer of JP Morgan Alternative Asset Management. Paul has been one of the leaders of JP Morgan Asset Management's hedge fund business since he co-founded the business in 1994. Celebrating their 30th year in business this year, Paul and his team manage over $35 billion in hedge fund assets for institutional and high net worth clients. It's a really interesting time for hedge funds right now. Unlike most investors, hedge fund managers get quite excited about things like volatility and abrupt policy changes because they're managing strategies that can actually capitalize on that volatility. And as we'll hear from Paul shortly, we're entering into an era of potentially higher alpha in hedge funds. So today, we'll talk about the past, present, and future of hedge fund investing. And who better to talk about this with than Paul, who's been in the middle of it for the last 30 years. It's a great conversation, so let's get right into it. Paul, welcome to Alternative Realities.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get started, could you give our listeners some background on your career and your role here at JP Morgan Asset Management?
Sure, you got it. I started out, I was always interested in technology and finance, and I wound up going the finance route at an early stage. And maybe a couple events happened early on that kind of really pushed me toward hedge funds. I was working actually at a plan sponsor and investing, kind of changing their asset allocation plan and researching. And that's when I first started looking at hedge funds. So this is back in 1992. And we started investing in effectively a number of quant market neutral managers like Numeric, who's part of Man these days, and others. And one of the more pivotal events was I met David Askin. I think we met them three times. So David Askin, for people who don't know, was a mortgage-backed derivative manager that wound up blowing up. And fortunately, we didn't invest. But I think it was a early days lessons learned. And, you know, we didn't invest, I think, partially because of skepticism, partially because we couldn't underwrite it completely. And it was just an early day lesson learned, you know, and maybe like it's good to learn lessons when you make mistakes. And I'd say it's great to learn lessons on other people's mistakes. And fortunately, it was the latter camp. But, you know, 2 years later, I wound up co-founding a group. And, you know, fast forward to today, we're managing $35 billion, 70 people in a group, half of which are involved in researching hedge fund managers as well as managing portfolios.
Okay. So I've heard you talk about hedge funds as an industry, not an asset class.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love if you could talk a little bit about what does that mean? And as we've worked together on putting the guide to alternatives together, we kind of came to the conclusion, we've got a chart there that we call the bubble chart that shows different alternative asset classes and where they fit in portfolios. And we actually decided to split the hedge fund bubble into absolute return hedge funds versus directional hedge funds. So could you talk a little bit about what are the differences between the different types of hedge funds? Mm-hmm. How do you look at categorizing them and why is that important for investors?
Yeah. So let me address the industry, not an asset class. So I think the first thing to recognize is if you look at the 10,000 hedge funds that are out there, the pairwise correlation is something like 0.35, right? So really what you have, it's not a homogeneous collection of managers. It's really a variety of strategies that have very different characteristics to it. You know, so that when people say, people look at it as like a whole, or they're looking at the averages, they're really missing the point of what hedge funds are and missing, I'd say, a lot of the value proposition of them. So the way I would think of it is that like different hedge fund strategies and ultimately managers are really tools in your toolkit, right? So, you know, if you have a toolkit and you're looking to hang a picture and you reach into the toolkit because you think all the tools are the same and you pull out a screwdriver and, you know, like you're going to get frustrated to hammer the nail with a screwdriver. And maybe you're going to come away saying, like, these tools don't make any sense, right? And it's not that the tools didn't make sense. It's the misapplication of them, right? So if you're looking for uncorrelated investments, maybe that's leading you toward relative value managers. If you're looking for downside protection, maybe that's leading you toward macro managers or CTAs. And if you're looking for, like, value add, you know, enhanced returns in portfolio, maybe that's going to lead you to long short or credit or activism, right? So, again, different tool for different purpose. So that's the way we look at it. So yeah, splitting at least into those two broad buckets is kind of aligned with that, right?
Yeah.
So Looking at more uncorrelated investments as kind of one bucket, so principally relative value and macro and other uncorrelated strategies, and then more directional strategies. So it could be conventional long short, could be credit, could be things that are, you know, if not unique to hedge funds, are arguably best executed through hedge fund forms. So things like activism, just quite interesting today, especially in places like Japan.
Or things like change in businesses.
So pushing for change in businesses, and you know, working with management, or in some cases working to effect change and perhaps even replace management.
Yeah, why is Japan particularly interesting right now for that?
Yeah, on Japan, it's been a big theme for us for a couple of years now, and I think it still has room to play out. There's been, you know, if you go back to when, you know, Abe was prime minister, you had 3 hours, the third hour was corporate governance reform, and like, you know, fast forward and kind of quicker story, you know, over the last number of years, there's been just a tremendous amount of regulatory market-related and even some political reform, which has led to a large number of improvements in for minority shareholders. So there's been increases in dividends and capital structures. ROEs have increased. Boards have changed for the better, and now you've really started to see not only improvements financial and operational, but you're starting to see M&A in Japan as well, which is very exciting. I think it will be the year of M&A. In Japan, and interestingly, like some of that M&A is coming not just from within, but from outside as well. So, like PE investors are actually coming in, and sometimes in a friendly way, sometimes in a hostile way. You know, very very unique for Japan, for sure.
Yeah, we've seen this across the alternative space, really in private equity, a lot more interest in investing outside of the U.S., outside of domestic markets, in areas like Europe and Japan. Mm-hmm. Particularly interesting this year as folks are looking for diversification. When I think about hedge funds, I think maybe first about institutions, kind of large pension funds and large capital allocators. Do hedge funds make sense in individual portfolios for high net worth investors, or how should we look at that?
Yeah, I would say for sure. And certainly we've seen strong demand and strong interest on both sides. I would even argue if you think about the typical high net worth investor versus an institution, like everything else equal, they probably are, they probably don't have the diversification that an institutional investor would have. Mm. And they probably don't have the options that an institutional investor might have. So like, if anything, I would say all the more reason why it might be interesting for a high net worth investor versus an institutional. But yeah, what we're seeing is, as I mentioned, like strong demand from both sides. I'd say one of the biggest themes on the client side is going into uncorrelated investments, as I mentioned before, in different forms. Again, principally relative value and macro strategies. So uncorrelated to equity and fixed income markets.
Right. So more defensive play.
It is defensive, but I think when people think defensive, they think, I'm going to make a forgettable return. I think it's, it's defensive with a, potential to make a, let's call it high single digit return, potentially more. Mm. So still a good, a good return. And many people are funding that from fixed income for different reasons. So, what's driven that is, like rising stock bond correlations. So the need for, diversification and need to build a more resilient portfolio is greater today than it's been in a really long time. Yeah. And then, 2022 with difficult equity and fixed income markets really just underscores that further. So, we've seen a lot of growth.
Yeah, and maybe kind of expanding on that and looking at how hedge funds have evolved over time and the interest in hedge funds. I think of the last couple of decades is maybe slower for the hedge fund industry because it's been tougher to generate alpha, right? Mm. And all stocks are going up. It's harder to generate alpha if you're doing a long short strategy or something like that. Can you touch on the reasons maybe for the weakness in interest in hedge funds over the last couple of decades, and how do you see the next decade playing out?
Yeah, well, there's been, broadly what you're saying, I acknowledge there's certainly been some weaker periods for hedge funds for sure. The last 5 years are are distinctly different, you know. So the alpha generation of hedge fund industry has been very strong, and I'd say, you know, exceptionally strong in certain areas. But maybe just to frame it, we've done a fair amount of work, and we're actually close to publishing a paper, which is, I'm not sure what the name of the paper is, and internally we call it the we call it the Alpha Winter, which kind of gets to your point. So to kind of maybe frame it, if you think about what broadly speaking, even though I don't want to look at the hedge fund industry as a, you know, as one thing, but like that being said, broadly speaking, what are the drivers of hedge fund excess return? And what is the environment? It really comes down to three things. One is volatility that's, you know, moderate to potentially high. The second is high levels of dispersion. Inversely would be lower levels of correlation. Mm. And the third is a risk-free rate that's greater than 2%. And if you look at the good old days of hedge fund investing, when you were generating, you know, a lot of alpha and a lot of excess return, generally those three variables were favorable so you had high volatility, you had high dispersion, and you had rates that were off zero. And
okay. What period of time are we talking about here?
So that's like 2009, 2010-ish, right. You know? And then the middle period, which is the period you're talking about, really was a period, you know, and let's call it maybe as long as a decade, a little less than a decade, where hedge fund excess returns, you know, went down considerably. And by the way, it wasn't just hedge fund excess returns. It was kind of like generally, you know, a lot of active management strategies had difficulty generating excess return.
Right.
And that broadly corresponded with central bank intervention, right? So central bank intervention brought down vol, it certainly brought down rates dramatically. It was very, very difficult to add that excess return. You know, good news is if you kind of fast forward to the most recent 5 years where much of that has ended, rates are off zero, volatility has been elevated, dispersion has been high, you've kind of gone back to the good old days of hedge fund excess return, hedge fund alpha. And you know, when we look out on the landscape, you know, economically, politically, otherwise, like, I think this environment's here to stay.
Yeah. So the end of the hedge fund winter.
End of the hedge fund winter, alpha winter, yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
So when I think about other themes maybe affecting the industry, we've got to talk about AI.
Sure.
Machine learning has been a big trend.
Absolutely.
How do you look at AI and what kind of impact is it having on the hedge fund industry?
Yeah, in certain areas, it's having a tremendous impact, but not just today. It's been that way for a while. So one of the, you know, decisions that we've made years ago was to embrace quant and really, you know, increasingly lean into it as a strategy, and we've been rewarded for it. So, you know, as an example, I think our first quant investment was. When was it? It was probably 25 years ago, you know, close to it. It was a long time ago. And our first machine learning based manager, machine learning focused exclusive manager, was more than a decade ago.
Right. You know? So this is way pre ChatGPT.
Yeah,
this is
exactly so. Right. So, you know, obviously the world has found ChatGPT, LLM more broadly, and, you know, excited about it and should be excited about it. But like, on the hedge fund side, this has been, you know, broadly AI has been in usage for a long time. And I'd say some of the most successful hedge funds out there oftentimes have, you know, certainly many of them have quant strategies and some of them have like pure or using machine learning, both in alpha generation as well as portfolio construction.
Right.
So, yeah.
So you see this working? Has this been successful as
working,
strategy?
Obviously the barrier to entry at times could be high, but it's as I mentioned, it's worked quite well. There are a large number of players out there, some excellent, you know, not some of them continue to kind of build out their strategy, but
right.
Yeah, it's extremely exciting. And, you know, realistically, like just taking a step back and like, how is the financial world going to change? I think this isn't going out on a limb, but, you know, AI and more systematic strategies, certainly more quantitative strategies or more quantitative usage is going to do nothing but increase. Right. And, you know, the core, I mean, maybe to go back to the beginning, the core drivers of it is just the exponential growth in data, you know, computing power, and going to data, structured and unstructured data, and obviously techniques to you know, utilize that data, utilize that computer power, like you know, machine learning and neural networks and things like that.
Very interesting. So we get a lot of questions in the Guy Talturner's mailbox about different hedge fund strategies. Mm-hmm. And I've listed here a few that are getting more attention recently. I'd love if you could do just a kind of quick rapid fire round where you give us brief explanation and share your thoughts on some of these strategies. We touched on this a little bit, Japanese corporate governance, but kind of how do you summarize your views on this?
Yeah. So I think, we talked about it a little bit. I'd say one thing that I didn't mention, which I think is interesting. If you look at money flows, because two years ago when we first went into Japanese corporate governance, I'd say very few people were invested in it, right? Like today, more people are investing in it. But interesting, if you look at dollar flows going into Japan, you're still like basically flat over 3 years.
Right.
So it's kind of odd. And I mean, that's kind of a good thing because I think it still has more legs to it, right? So I think we're in kind of halfway there. And you know, like scale of 1 to 10, conviction in Japanese corporate governance is probably a 9.5 today.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very high for sure.
Wonderful.
And you know, I think I mentioned before, like, I think this year will be the year of M&A in Japan.
Next one, discretionary macro.
Yeah.
What is it? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, so discretionary macro are managers that are taking both directional and relative value positions based on their macroeconomic outlook across different asset classes. So fixed income, FX, commodities, equities. And, you know, what makes that strategy attractive is one, volatility. And in, you know, some of those asset classes, there is, you know, pretty good volatility. There's obviously a lot going on the rates front across different countries and different geographies. And then, you know, second, what you want to see is ideally things that are moving differently across, you know, across countries or across regions, right? So maybe rates in Japan are going up, but rates in the U.S. are coming down. And not that you're necessarily playing one versus the other, but it gives you more opportunities to make money, right? If there were just like effectively like six bets out there, you know, then you're not going to be able to put enough risk to work in a disciplined way. But if there's a lot of movements across a lot of different asset classes, it gives you just the ability to build a portfolio in a better way. So both of those things are in place today. And yeah, macro, we like. It's a lower Sharpe strategy. You know, it's going to be comes with a certain amount of volatility, but it also has interesting, I wouldn't say hedging characteristics, but it tends to protect a portfolio or at least perform differently in more tail-oriented environments. So, yeah, scale of 1 to 10, I'm going to give that a 8 today.
Okay, it's pretty high conviction. Reinsurance.
Yeah, strategy everyone loves to hate.
Why is that?
So reinsurance is, I mean, you're basically writing insurance for insurance companies, right? So if you're, you know, you have an insurance company accumulating risk, they may conclude that they have too much risk in certain areas and they want to lay off some of that risk. And, you know, a reinsurance provider is going to be the one that kind of accepts that risk.
Okay.
And then there's something called retro as well, which is effectively insurance for reinsurance companies. Same kind of idea.
Okay,
it just gets more and more, customized, and you're insuring against perils, you know, natural disasters. So hurricane and earthquake and wildfires. And, you know, I think most people would say, why would I ever want to do that? That sounds horrible.
Yeah, a lot of hurricanes lately, a lot of wildfires lately.
Yeah, and I'd say, like, I get it. And obviously, there's a longer conversation around global warming. But, you know, I would just say that everything has a price, you know, and like it's a market that is very cyclical. And there's times to enter the market, times to back off the market. And if you size it correctly in your portfolio and you have the conviction, you have the wherewithal, and you could live through, the choppiness of what it might present over a multi-year period, you generally come out, do all those things, you could come out well. We certainly have done well in reinsurance despite, you know, some of the headlines that are out there.
Right.
And I should say it's also uncorrelated to traditional assets or pretty much everything.
Right. You don't know when a natural disaster is going to happen. It's not following the stock market.
No, it's not.
Okay. Last strategy, tax aware strategies.
Yeah, taxed and warehouse. So, I mean, less of a, you know, less of a thematic view and more of maybe a development. And, you know, I should say that, and also certainly a very interesting one. So, you know, just to put it in perspective, so for a U.S. investor, hedge fund investing is not always the most tax efficient form of investing, right? And which is why we think also equal, you probably see, you know, incrementally more demand offshore. But that's led to a number of tax aware strategies. So like the most typical approach is really a tax loss harvesting strategy. So, you know, assuming you have longs and you have shorts, like everything else equal, if you have a, you know, something on the long side that you continue to have a positive view on, and it's, you know, you've been holding it for 9 months, well, why not hold it for 12 months, right? And because then you'll get long-term capital treatment. And as it turns out, if you kind of factor in like the tax consequences of, you know, holding it, I mean, it turns out you don't even have to have a spectacular view on it. Like the tax impact of that is going to make it attractive, right? And then, you know, on the other side, you know, if you have losing investments, you want to realize those, you want to harvest them, and you want to, you know, have short-term losses against those. So that's the traditional way to do it. I should, you know, caveat it all with any of those strategies, you really need to look at it as an investment first and foremost. And yes, maybe some of them have tax, you know, features that are attractive, but like you have to underwrite it as an investment first. But yeah, the tax loss harvesting is definitely a trend. That's interesting. We think that there are things that are probably even more interesting than conventional approaches without unpacking it all. Yeah, we're pursuing a number of those things.
Yeah, you certainly wouldn't be as successful as you are if you were taking conventional approaches to everything, I'm sure.
One of the things that has helped differentiate us is our openness and, you know, what we say is kind of casting a wide net toward, you know, unique strategies, unique managers of all different sizes, small, large, medium, whatever it is. We're just looking for, you know, alpha and unique investments.
Maybe just touching on that more, like how do you, as a multi-strategy manager, how do you kind of get the best out of managers, build the best portfolio? How does that sort of approach work? How do you add value there?
Yeah, I'd say our value add, you know, it's probably four different areas, right? So like the first one, and I'll try to be brief, you know, the first one's kind of manager selection, right? So like there's maybe different forms. I mean, look, first and foremost, we need to produce returns, we need to produce alpha, right?
Right.
But also clients look to us, especially having a 30-year relationship, to get them access to certain elite managers that are out there. There's always an element of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the third piece of that, I'd say, is not just finding, you know, not just giving them access to elite managers that are out there, the DSHRs, so to speak, but it's finding tomorrow's elite managers today.
Okay.
You know, and that gets to kind of the early stage investing. So, you know, that's the first part. You know, the second is strategy selection. So I mentioned something like, you know, we were just talking about reinsurance, Japanese corporate governance.
Yeah, we just mentioned four. You're looking at very broad array.
You need to look broad. You need to have a view on your strategies. You need to weight them differently depending on where you are in the cycle, and hopefully add value through those decisions.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously portfolio management. So we're putting those together in a portfolio. There's ways to think about sizing. There's ways to think about downside. We're really looking through these investments in terms of what they're holding. How do they perform in different areas? So again, portfolio management is critically important. And then lastly, you know, client engagement and client partnership. So we're often, you know, helping train clients on different hedge fund strategies. We're giving them our views. We're helping them. We're oftentimes forming completion portfolios. So they're investing away from us maybe in hedge funds, and we're complementing what they do with certain strategies. Could be emerging managers, could be quant, you know, differentiated things. So I'd say all four of those ways.
Great. Before we finish, you published a thought piece recently that I really enjoyed called, I think it was called 30 Pearls of Wisdom.
Yes.
Based on your 30 years of investing in the hedge fund industry. Could you give us a few of those pearls here for listeners?
Sure. Maybe a handful. So the first, which I think is critical for our success over 30 years, is be a skeptic. you know? And I think that's a good rule when you're doing due diligence in any asset class, but I'd say especially on the hedge fund side for a number of reasons, given the complexity therein. So, you know, the first is be a skeptic. Another one is the truth is out there. And this really gets to, you know, not only networking, but reference checks. It's one of the areas where I think, you know, while people may say they do reference checks, I think there's a lot of nuance to it. And it's, to me, one of the most important aspects of due diligence is actually reference checks. So, you know, maybe that's the second. And then the third would be from the great philosopher Mike Tyson, who said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Love that quote.
It's a great quote. And, you know, I mean, there's a couple of different ways you could go in that. I think the way, you know, I was thinking of it is that it's effectively like one thing to buy a track record that's on paper, right? And it's one thing to sign up and say, I'm going to buy this manager and they have a 10% vol. And again, maybe you've seen some of the drawdowns on paper. It's a different thing, and, you know, and you have a plan theoretically that, yeah, I could live through this and, you know, yeah, I'd see it's going to end up well and da da da. It's an entirely different thing to, you know, think you're going to live with it on paper and then actually have it play out in reality, i.e. get punched in the face and be in that drawdown and maybe your boss is breathing down your, you know, you know, is on your back and your clients are coming at you and it plays out. I think I said it, like it plays out in dog years sometimes.
Right.
And for you to do the right thing as that's playing out is entirely different than buying it on paper, unless you've lived through that. And unless, you know, more importantly, unless you really have built the conviction in the manager and maybe see it as a buying opportunity, not a reason to run away, then, you know, you can't realistically live with it. So I think it's the most important thing. I'm a, you know, big believer in behavioral theory and issues, and we're all kind of fighting against doing the wrong thing. That quote really resonates. This, you can see the enthusiasm.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So a big lot of approaches you take to evaluating managers.
Yep.
So, Paul, that was a really insightful discussion. Thank you very much for coming on Alternative Realities.
Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for everybody tuning in today. Really appreciate it.
That was Paul Zummo, Chief Investment Officer of JP Morgan Alternative Asset Management. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our quarterly guide to alternatives at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions in current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.